Usually when we talk about a test or, you know, a trial, there's this expectation of a really rigid, unforgiving structure.
Right, like a binary outcome.
Exactly. You sit down with your number two pencil, you fill in the little bubbles on a Scantron sheet, and at the end of it, you either pass or you fail.
Yeah.
It's clean. It's measured.
Well, and we crave that kind of binary categorization, I think, because life is inherently messy.
Oh, definitely.
A definitive score gives us this this artificial sense of certainty. Like, it's telling us exactly where we stand in a chaotic world.
Right. But then you step into the source material we're exploring today, and that whole grading rubric is completely thrown out the window.
Oh, totally.
Because today we are looking at a stack of narrative logs from a fantasy setting, specifically the intertwined realms of Mirari and Ainnicton.
Right. And, you know, on the surface, these logs read like your classic high fantasy.
Yeah, you have knights, dragons, warlocks.
Yeah. Ruined temples, all of that.
Well, exactly. But our mission for this deep dive today is to look past the armor and the spells. We're going to extract the profound psychological and philosophical nuggets hidden within these narratives.
Yeah, and we're looking at three distinct trials from the text to do this. There's a trial of the heart, a trial of the body, and a trial of the mind.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the first trial, the trial of the heart.
So this section operates as a really profound exploration of empathy, guilt, and like the actual mechanics of forgiveness.
It's heavy stuff.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the text drops us into this incredibly evocative scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's a misty garden under a moonlit sky.
Mm-hmm.
And right in the center sits this beautiful marble statue of a rearing winged horse, a Pegasus named Lady Ariel.
Right.
But then the silence is suddenly broken by a loud crack and the statue just shatters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The Pegasus's sad face is just left looking blankly up at the sky.
Hmm.
And into this garden step two storytellers who are tasked by this this disembodied voice in the mists to explain how this happened and how it can be fixed.
Right. And those storytellers are a little girl known as Princess Angel and this weary cloak-wearing man.
Yeah.
And through them, we realize we're actually looking at a dual tragedy. There are two parallel stories happening across these two realms.
Exactly.
In the more grounded sort of real world of Ainnicton, a young man named John Harcourt broke the statuette.
Mm.
And he did it in a moment of anger. The text actually notes that he thought it was safe to take his inner torment out on things.
Right. And that psychological displacement is so common.
Yeah.
Like, we punch a wall or throw a phone because we are trying to safely contain our destructive emotions. We convince ourselves that because, you know, things don't feel, our anger has no victim.
But the narrative forces us to look at the mirror image of this in the magical realm of Mirari.
Right.
Here, the warlock Lord Eorin, who carries the terrifying titles of the Year's End or the Destroyer, he struck down the living Lady Ariel.
Wow.
Yeah, and he didn't do it as a safe displacement of anger. He did it in a moment of intense feeling of betrayal.
Oh, so it was targeted.
Exactly. He felt unloved by his brother and sister, so he wanted to hurt them by destroying the creature they loved most.
That's fascinating. So John Harcourt broke a symbol of love in ignorance, while Lord Eowyn destroyed a living being in this, like, momentary flash of vengeful pain.
Right.
But both acts leave a shattering impact, creating this really devastating cycle of guilt.
Which brings us to the little girl, Princess Angel, and her philosophy of healing.
Yeah, this part is beautiful.
It really is. She kneels by this broken marble face and says, "Maybe all the lines don't go away, the cracks, but something almost new that you fixed is always better than something broken and in pieces."
Oh, I love that.
Right. It instantly brings to mind Kintsugi. The Japanese art.
Oh, repairing broken pottery with lacquer dusted with powdered gold.
Exactly. But here it's applied to human psychology. It's this profound statement on resilience.
Right. Because Kintsugi treats breakage and repair as part of the history of an object rather than a flaw you have to disguise.
Yeah.
And when we apply that mechanically to the human psyche, we are really talking about post-traumatic growth.
Mm.
A person who has been broken, who is actively engaged in the difficult work of repairing themselves with kindness and accountability, they develop a more robust psychological architecture than someone who has never faced adversity.
Because the cracks become evidence of strength.
Exactly.
But, you know, I found myself questioning the source material's handling of the villain here.
Oh, how so?
Well, Lord Eowyn literally becomes a dark lord, right? Reigning in terror for half a century. Can a single act done in a flash of ignorant rage permanently bind someone to a life of evil?
Well, what's fascinating here is how the text deconstructs the whole concept of villainy.
Okay.
The weary man telling the story points out that Lord Eon wasn't inherently, like, biologically evil.
Right.
He did the unforgivable thing. And because his guilt was so immense, he became bound by the rules to his fate as the destroyer.
Oh, so the guilt trapped him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He spends 50 years conducting dark magic, raising corpses, and conjuring ghosts.
Mm.
But if we look at the mechanics of why he uses necromancy, it changes everything.
How do you mean?
He wasn't building an undead army for world conquest.
Oh, wait. He was doing agonizing research. He was trying to undo his mistake.
Yes. He needed Lady Ariel to have true, real life again.
Wow.
Because a shambling corpse or a ghost couldn't give him the one thing he actually needed to survive his own mind, which was her forgiveness.
That is wow.
Right? His 50 years of rage and necromancy were just a physical manifestation of unresolved guilt. Guilt anchors us to the past.
Yeah, it makes us obsess over reviving dead moments rather than living in the present.
Exactly. He was trapped trying to reanimate a corpse because he didn't know how to forgive himself.
That reframing makes the climax of this trial incredibly moving.
It really does.
Because Princess Angel, who has this ultimate gift of healing, she finds Ariel's preserved body deep in Eowyn's fortress. And she manages to bring the Pegasus back to true life. And Lord Eon is hiding in the room, invisible, completely stunned.
I can imagine.
Ariel walks right up to him, touches her nose to his face, and simply says, "I forgive you."
Wow.
Yeah. And in that single second, 50 years of mindless rage against an uncaring universe just vanishes. He whispers, "I'm sorry," turns translucent, and is finally allowed to rest.
The psychological release there is instantaneous.
Completely.
And it forces a very real reflection on our own lives. We often carry the crushing weight of a past mistake, replaying old arguments in our heads, effectively practicing our own emotional necromancy.
Oh, that's a great way to put it, emotional necromancy.
Right. We let that guilt harden us into defensive, angry versions of ourselves simply because we haven't found a way to ask for or, you know, internalize forgiveness.
Yeah, and dropping that kind of emotional baggage is essential because you cannot navigate the physical world if you are weighed down by the past. Which moves us seamlessly from unburdening the heart to pacing the body. This leads directly to the second trial on the Mountain of Monsters.
Oh, this one is incredibly visceral.
It really is. The Mists part and the Champions find themselves in this massive stone cavern. On one side, there's a gargantuan keg of red wine. Mm-hmm. And far away, down a perilous tunnel, is the silhouette of a gargantuan hand holding the empty chalice of the Titan King.
So they have to ferry the wine.
Exactly. The champions must ferry wine from the keg to the chalice using normal-sized goblets, but the path is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, it's a gauntlet designed to test physical and mental pacing.
Right.
The path is blocked by a sleeping, spined boar, essentially a monstrous porcupine.
Uh-huh.
And beyond that is an ice drake that shoots freezing frost and a churning pool with a toothy maw lurking inside it.
Terrifying.
Totally. And the champions are given a map with a fundamental choice at every juncture, safety or speed.
So let's look at how Lady Redmayne, the warrior, approaches this.
Yeah.
She relies on pure explosive velocity. She fills a goblet and just sprints. She vaults over the sleeping boar beautifully.
Because she's so fast.
Exactly. She dodges the ice drake's freezing breath because of that speed. But then she slips on the frost the drake left behind.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And splashes half her wine onto the stone. She reaches the Titan's chalice, pours in the meager remains, and shouts in frustration, "I have to do better than this."
She assumes that moving faster minimizes her exposure to danger.
Right.
It's a completely instinctive response to fear, just get out of the threat zone as quickly as possible.
It reminds me of driving on ice.
Oh, right.
Like if you hit a slick patch on the highway and your car starts to slide, your panic instinct tells you to slam on the gas to power through it or slam on the brakes to stop.
Yeah, but either of those aggressive actions makes you lose control completely.
Exactly. You actually have to take your foot off the pedal, let the momentum settle, and gently steer to regain traction.
Right.
Redmayne is essentially slamming on the gas while standing on frost.
Which perfectly explains why her eventual adaptation actually works.
Right.
She realizes her speed is generating her failure. So on her final run, she forces herself to slow down. She takes a narrow, claustrophobic fissure path to avoid the drake entirely.
Oh, smart.
And brilliantly, she decides to carry two goblets at once.
Oh.
Yeah, she trades velocity for volume. By moving methodically and doubling her capacity, she navigates the rubble without spilling a drop and fills the Titan's cup.
That physical recalibration is so fascinating, especially to contrast with our second champion, Sir Lefelon.
Oh man, Lefong.
He is the polar opposite of Redmayne's shoot-first approach. He analyzes every single step, checking his mech constantly. He tiptoes, but his physical caution is generated by this spiraling mental overthinking. He's carrying this cup of wine, tiptoeing past the snoring spiked boar, and in his head, he's having a full-blown existential crisis.
Over what?
He's wondering if he should deliberately fail so his friends can win.
Oh.
Yeah.
He's questioning the morality of the entire test while standing inches away from a monster.
You know, we've all experienced this exact paralysis.
Have we?
Oh, definitely. Think about it. You're sitting at your desk, drafting a seemingly high-stakes email to your boss.
Oh, right.
You write a sentence, delete it, stare at the screen for 45 minutes, terrified that a slight misphrasing will ruin your career.
Yeah, totally.
You turn a mundane logistical update into an existential crisis, projecting your internal anxiety onto an external task until the task feels insurmountable.
That is painfully relatable.
Right.
And LaFallon's internal distraction leads to this incredible, almost slapstick climax.
What happens?
He is so bogged down in his own overthinking that he literally trips over his own feet and falls flat on his face, right on top of the dreaded spined boar.
Oh no.
He lands directly on the monster.
Does it attack him?
No. The beast yelps in absolute terror and runs away into the darkness. Yeah. Llewellyn picks himself up, realizes he barely has a scratch, and says, "Well, that was one beast that was more scared of me than I was of it."
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
But also, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it reveals a profound truth about the obstacles we face.
How so?
Yeah, LaFellon's monsters were largely constructed in his own imagination.
Right.
He allowed his overanalysis to turn a sleeking animal into an impassable barrier.
Ah, I see.
It forces us to examine the monsters blocking our own paths. Maybe a difficult conversation you've been avoiding, a career pivot, or a creative project.
Yeah.
How many of those obstacles are actually terrified of you?
Yeah.
How many are just waiting for you to stumble forward, fall flat on your face,
Yeah.
and realize the barrier was infinitely more fragile than your anxiety led you to believe?
Exactly. Sometimes you just have to trip over the board to realize you own the cavern.
That's a great way to put it.
And the symmetry here is brilliant because Redmayne's physical rushing and LaFallon's mental overthinking directly set up the third and final test. We move from the physical agility of the Titan's cavern to the mental agility required in the trial of the mind.
Oh, the Hydra.
Yes. This takes place in a ruined temple, shrouded in flickering torchlight, and the judge is a nine-headed Hydra.
And the Hydra presents the champions with the grid of nine puzzle boxes.
Right.
These are classic riddles, testing pattern recognition, anagrams, numerical progressions, and trivia. And once again, we have two champions with entirely different cognitive frameworks stepping up to the challenge.
Right. First is Monitor, a massive steely dragon,
Okay.
and his personality is dripping with ancient arrogance. He clatters his spines, completely annoyed that he has to stoop to the level of playing riddles.
Because he thinks he's above it.
Oh, absolutely. He actually refers to human virtues as sodden mortal qualities.
Wow.
Yeah. He is supremely confident, but his rigid thinking causes him to fail several puzzles completely.
Yeah, his attempt at puzzle five is the perfect example of how a rigid mental framework causes us to miss obvious truths.
Remind me, how does that one go?
So puzzle five is presented as a visual grid of letters. The top row is X, H, W.
Okay.
The second row is T, A, E, and the bottom row is L, Z in a blank space.
Right.
Monitor arrogantly declares the missing letter must be P, because he is trying to calculate the alphabetical gaps between the letters.
Oh, I see.
He is forcing a complex mathematical framework onto the problem, and the Hydra tells him he is incorrect.
Because the puzzle has absolutely nothing to do with the alphabet. It's
Excellent.
purely about physical geometry. You just count the straight intersecting lines used to draw the letters.
Right.
X has two lines, H has three, W has four.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow that progression on the bottom row, L has two lines, Z has three lines, so the answer must be a letter constructed of four lines, like M.
So Monitor entirely misses the simple physical reality sitting right in front of him because he's trapped in his own overcomplicated logic.
Right.
This illustrates the danger of siloed intelligence. Like, Monitor has an immense capacity for logic, but he applies the exact same tool to every problem. When reality doesn't conform to his tool, he experiences massive cognitive dissonance.
Which leads to my absolute favorite irony in this entire deep dive.
I'll puzzle eight.
Yes. The Hydra gives Monitor a box of letters NDRUCUNO.
Okay.
And Monitor doesn't even attempt to solve it. His cognitive dissonance boils over into a full tantrum.
Naturally.
He starts yelling at the Hydra, complaining about being stuck in this, quote, conundrum.
And the letters spell the word conundrum arranged in a spiral.
Exactly.
He solves the puzzle entirely by accident, simply by complaining about his own frustration.
Right. The Hydra just grins and gives it to him.
Wow.
Monitor takes his accidental win and stomps out of the cavern, learning absolutely nothing.
That's so fitting.
It really is. But then we see our final champion, Thomas the Lord Explorer.
Oh, Thomas is great. He's the embodiment of intellectual humility. Where Monitor snarls and dictates, Thomas bows and observes. When he approaches the puzzles, he draws on an incredibly diverse cross-cultural background to find the answers.
Oh, definitely.
We see him use memories from a Mortal World Sunday school to solve a puzzle about the fruits of the spirit, tracing love, joy, and peace down to the answer, self-control.
Mm-hmm.
Then he pivots seamlessly to global mythology for the final puzzle, referencing Steno and Uriel as the sisters of Medusa, the Norse fate Skuld, and the biblical figure Abednego.
It's so impressive.
He pulls from completely different disciplines because he has spent his life being genuinely curious about everything.
Right. He's built a flexible web of mental models rather than a single rigid ladder.
Exactly.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Thomas, this brilliant, well-read explorer, gets to puzzle eight, the conundrum puzzle.
Uh-oh.
The exact same puzzle that the arrogant dragon solved by accident. And Thomas looks at it, thinks deeply, and says, I am afraid I do not know. The solution eludes me.
Wow.
He actually fails the puzzle that the dragon passed.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I initially hated that. It felt deeply unfair after his whole display of humble brilliance. Why wouldn't the source material reward him with a perfect score?
Well, because a perfect score implies that the learning process is finished.
Oh, interesting.
The author is proving a vital philosophical point here. True intellect isn't defined by an endless capacity to hoard trivia.
Right.
It is defined by the boundary condition, how you handle the edge of your own map.
Oh, I love that.
Monitor solved the puzzle by accident, learned nothing, and left angry because his ego was threatened. Thomas failed, but he accepted his limit with total grace.
Yeah.
He bows to the Hydra and notes that failing the puzzle merely reminds him that there was always more for me to learn, more reasons for me to continue my travels.
He views the limit of his knowledge not as an insult, but as an invitation.
Exactly. And when we face a logistical nightmare at work or a complex conflict in our personal lives, we have a choice.
Right.
We can react with Monitor's defensive arrogance, furious that the world is testing us with a conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can approach it with Thomas's curious humility, recognizing it as an opportunity to expand our web of understanding.
It completely shifts how you view friction in your daily life.
It really does.
Friction stops being a threat and starts being a teacher.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean for you sitting here listening in the real world?
Well, from the Garden of the Broken Pegasus, we see that carrying guilt anchors us to the past.
Right.
And true healing requires the courage to both offer and accept forgiveness.
And from the Cavern of the Titan King, we see that sprinting past our problems often makes us lose control. Navigating obstacles requires us to slow down and realize the monsters in our path are often just manifestations of our own anxiety.
Exactly. And from the Temple of the Hydra, we learn that true intellect isn't about having all the answers. It's about having the humility to say, I don't know, but I want to learn.
It's such a powerful set of lessons.
It is. And this raises an important question, actually. One final thought that echoes across all three of these settings.
Oh.
If you look closely at the mechanics of these trials, the judges, the voice in the misty garden, the Titan King waiting for his wine, the Hydra with its riddles, they never actually punish the champions.
Oh, wow. You're right.
Right. When Redmayne spills the wine, the Titan doesn't smite her. When Monitor gets a puzzle wrong, the Hydra doesn't attack him.
They just wait.
Exactly. The judges simply wait. They wait for the champions to pick up the pieces, to recalibrate their approach, and to try again.
That's incredible.
So what if the trials we face in life aren't pass or fail exams designed to break us? What if they are merely mirrors designed to show us who we are right now and who we have the capacity to become?
Wow. We started this deep dive talking about Scantrons and binary grading rubrics.
Yeah.
But maybe the test isn't about getting a perfect score. Maybe the test is just seeing if you're willing to pick up the pencil again after you've made a mistake.
I couldn't agree more.
Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. We hope you take these lessons from Mirari and Innington and use them to navigate your own obstacles with a little more grace, a little more patience, and a lot more curiosity. Until next time, keep exploring your own story.